Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. Thanks for joining me wherever you are. My name is Nicholas Claude. Turns out opening a Patreon account is a little more complicated than I first anticipated. I don't know, maybe it's just my age. I've not found the process user-friendly at all so far, but I will let you know when you can start donating to the project. My guest this week is the activist and former trade unionist Frank Manches. He's been on the podcast a couple of times. I turned to Frank for a fresh perspective on the world around us. He is incredibly well-connected and has some interesting things to say about South Africa and its prospects for the future. We covered a number of areas, including the state of the civil service. He reflected on his time working with now President Cyril Ramaphosa back in his trade union days. The need for the trade unions, a little bit more about the state of the trade unions, the need for the trade unions to become more engaged in the debate on economic policy. And then I asked him to wave his magic wand and how he would turn around the economy. So please enjoy my chat with Frank. Frank, thanks for your time this morning, and good to see you again.
Yes, great.
I can't even remember. This is actually your third appearance on the podcast, which makes you like the VIP guest, I suppose, or the sort of guy I go to if I'm struggling for a guest. But it's always good to talk to you, and I always appreciate your input. I appreciate your positivity and your realism as much as anything else, and I appreciate your commitment to your belief in a better society for all, which seems to me to be more urgent and necessary than ever. I mean, I had Richard Poplack, who writes for the Daily Maverick. I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work.
I had him as my guest read his work.
Last week. You should listen to that podcast. That was pretty grim, you know. Moments of optimism, but generally he painted a very bleak picture of not only where we are in South Africa in terms of sort of internal struggles of the ANC and what the implications of that are, this ongoing state capture project, but also the world and climate change and the politics of the big powers, Trump, Johnson, the sort of rise of the right wing, which we kind of touched on a bit in our previous discussions. I wanted to just sort of maybe look ahead a little bit to 2020 from your perspective. I mean, you were telling me a little bit about a party you attended on New Year's Eve, and maybe you could just give me a sense of the tone of the discussion there, and we can maybe take it from there.
Yes, I think there were many old stalwarts there, and they were debating among themselves what is the root, the root of some of the crisis. Some of them had been in exile and very deep in the movement, and they emphasized very different things. And what was interesting was sometimes they made you think about things that one doesn't often think about. So one person really went on a great deal about the state of the civil service. Now, I was trying to talk about leadership and really the capacity, although the likelihood, you know, of the president taking stronger leadership action in a couple areas. And they immediately leapt from that straight to say, well, the only thing that concerned them was the state of the civil service, and that he should actually make the resolve that he would actually, like in the early days, bring in people, I guess, through some sort of horizontal entry, who are more activist-minded into the civil service. And I said, well, why would that be? He said, well, if you don't do that, what we then are left with is a huge Bantustan culture in the civil service, and that it's, you know, it was dampened in the early days, but it has a resurgence now, which is really, I guess, that thing of moving at the pedestrian pace, really bureaucratic minded, and he said that the whole civil service is afflicted in that way by that. And then he also went on to discuss, I guess, the problems facing the problems related to the trade unions in the civil service, and saying, well, they also needed to be dealt with, because we all come from a background where we emphasize the role of trade unions, but you know, it is possible. I mean, even if you go back to sort of looking at the States and the Teamsters, you can see that, you know, trade unions can lodge themselves in a way that isn't forward-looking, that isn't transformative, that is limited, and make certain kind of alliances which are negative. But overall, I think the view was pessimistic. I think just lastly to say is that my own view of 2020 is that, firstly, I do know that global issues will be featuring, you know, as a bigger in my area of concern. And I take into account...
What do you mean by that?
Well, I take into account the issues like, for example, the standard ones that we know, Brexit and Trump. But, yeah, I would like to add more particular issues, like what is happening in human rights in Sri Lanka, what's happening in India.
India with the Muslim population.
The switch to the right. And my worry there that if a kind of Hindu nationalism initially targets Muslims, then who will it target next, and who will it target next? And I think there are numerous flashpoints like that where human rights are curtailed, and I guess Democrats and also left-wing people are facing increased repression. And then alongside that, you do have this tendency, I guess, through nationalism, to visit repression on whole population groups, that whole idea that you can have cleansing. So the global thing will be my one area of interest. And then, of course, my other area of interest would be, well, what is it that we do back home about getting ourselves out of the rut? And I think you know my opinion on that. My opinion really is, South Africans, wake up. How do you understand how change occurs? And change does not occur with you outsourcing it to the ruling party, to one party. So, for example, when elections come, don't sit with three cards on the table. One is a blue card, the DA. Another is the red card. And then you've got the card of, like, the oldest liberation movement. And then you look at the cards and you say, well, who can I now outsource to? Then you look at the blue and you say, well, I actually don't like it because of the economic policies. The red, you say, these are a lot of younger people. I'm not their target group. And then you give it sort of, you know, then to the one which has that history or has all those good policies. And then you go away, and then you want to come back the next, after the 5 years. And then do that again. And then in between, you look at, for example, the electricity blackouts that go on, you know, up to stage 2, 3, 4, 5, and you say, how is this possible? How is it happening? And you're surprised. And why are you surprised? Why would you be surprised? So the thing to do is, if you give your vote anyway, keep following up on it. And I've said this to you before. Once you've allocated that vote, don't walk away. Hold accountable. Follow up. Ask and demand report backs. And in fact, you then become responsible for the one you've outsourced it to stand up. So your big thing, whoever you give it to, whatever cards you lay on the table, do stand up in the next 5 years on particular issues that whoever you've outsourced your leadership, your activity to, wherever they divert or veer off the path that you think is the right path. We don't understand how change occurs. We just think, well, we'll just saunter up to the voting station on a particular time, then we'd walk away, and then we'd have all these surprises. But I think, when I look at 2020, the only other thing I would say is that I would advise people who are activist-minded, really advocates for human rights, is to pay a lot more attention, I guess, on your own resilience. What's important in times like these is actually to be, I suppose, internally strong, and get strong in your mind and strong in I guess, your own self-care, you know, what you read, how you are looking after that. And then from that base, it's not saying that one turns inwards. It's from that base then that you intervene and get involved, and you are critical. And then you are critical from that base, not of depression, of anger and negativity. And you can also be a light to other activists you meet, younger activists, and you would be thinking clearly. And in that way, I think one of the things that I would say to people, it being January and a time when people are making resolutions, is to look at those things that will make you strong and keep you strong, so that whenever you're out there, you are, I suppose, that positive force that we need to take us forward.
I just want to go back. I did write here, role of trade unions in formulating economic policy. You seem to hint that there's perhaps a feeling among certain people that the trade unions have become a hindrance to progress, if I can use a very broad term. And I do miss kind of policy input from trade unions. Maybe I'm just not reading the right publications or documentation, but, you know, when you hear Cassata about, okay, SAA must fire the board or you know, ESCA must fire the board, that doesn't seem to really be kind of where the trade union should be contributing. That I would have expected a bit more of a systematic and structured response to particularly the state of these SOEs like South African Airways and the power utility Eskom. What is your sort of response to that?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that we have to bear in mind with the trade unions. So the first is that you have trade unions who are, I guess, in the public service, and that you know, and in the SOE. So in the public service, you look at SATU and NAHAO, and you would want trade unions post liberation to both look after the interests of their members specifically, but also to have that broader interest and broader vision about social change. And it's on that second part that they often do fall down. So if you're a trade union in a state-owned enterprise like ESCO, if your gaze is only on your members and, you know, the well-being of your members, you will miss a whole lot of things that are happening in that institution, whereas, in fact, you are well-positioned, to get information. You're well-positioned to analyze it and study it and make interventions about it. And you're also well in a good position to alert the public about that. And it's not as if somebody's adding to your role on something that doesn't interest you. What happens then if you allow, plunder, corruption to continue on a big scale where you actually have a strong presence? In the end, when that particular entity is eroded, it's not fair. But what then comes back to bite you is job losses, because the entity can't actually sustain itself. And then I guess the third level beyond your own interests as a union, why you should be doing that is your own principles and vision and mission that you have for to move the society forward. So those are some of the things that one sees at the level of the individual union. But I think one of the things that we do need to look at is the level also of the federations. And I think you will recall in the early 90s, the capacity of the trade unions to do the thinking work, to engage teams of people to actually do really substantive work and make real, real strong proposals.
Proper research and policy structures.
Yeah. Mm. And in fact, they had a big influence. I think the RDP document that came out of the ANC was strongly influenced by the unions. And so the unions have had that capacity. So federations then can play a very a more visionary role, a very strategic role. I guess at the level that the individual unions sometimes can't. Now we've got these two federations. So I guess just to jump to where they are, we know that the one split away. NUMSA was kicked out of COSATU because of its critique of Jacob Zuma. Then we saw the formation of the second federation, SAFTU. But now where they both are, they're realizing the deep, deep crisis there is, and they are starting to have talks.
COSATU and SAFTU.
They have been having meetings.
Okay.
Part of this may or may not have started last year when Bladen Zimande made a call at the May Day in 2018, saying that actually they are in an alliance with COSATU, but they want to reach out to any progressive structure, and they want to see why it is that the two federations can't emphasize, you know, what unites them. And Vavi is on record as saying that these talks have happened. They are saying, let's leave whatever is the past in the past because we can't change it, but actually we can change everything for the future. And let's put everything on the table in the interest of unity. Of course, the one thing that divides them is, again, I guess the attitude and the critique of the president. So in the same discussion that Vavi was having about this, reporting about this, he was unapologetic in his critique of the president, saying that he's utterly disappointed that someone...
President Ramaphosa. Valenzina Vavi was.
Comes from a background of the unions, can actually be leading things along the path that he is, and saying, well, actually, that sort of represents interests that are anathema to the unions. But there is such talk, and I'm so glad that I'm able to, you know, that we're able to get such news, because if you look in the last... since Cyril Ramaphosa has been president, there's been a million or just over a million job losses in contrast to his promise. Mm. And I guess if you look at how the fallout of the state capture and the plunders, the unions are, and the working class and workers are being the brunt of possible job losses at SA and at ESCOM. It is time to come together for these federations.
You mentioned now President Ramaphosa, and I've written down here CRY ? Like, I'm still trying to kind of work out why he was so desperate to be president.
Yeah, I think that if you look at...
Because apparently he spent a lot of money.
If you look at Cyril and Ramaphosa and understand him...
Do you know him?
Yes, I know him quite well. I guess I've had a lot of experience working with him in the union days. In our COSATU offices, we would often be planning for the CECs and planning different campaigns. And I think, you know, because of how big NUM was and how busy he was, Cyril wasn't often directly in the meetings of the Central Executive Committee and the National Executive Committee. He would send some other leaders from the NUM. But we, you know, Jay and I do in particular, but also Sydney Mufamadi, would actually then make arrangements to see and consult with Cyril to make sure that NUM was there on board and also to get that guidance. So they had those interactions. So there are two sides, I guess, to Cyril. The one side is, I guess, his commitment to a whole range of principles. One of those would have been democracy, anti-apartheid, and, of course, in building NUM, the rights of workers and mine workers. But there's another side to him that became quite clear in the early 90s, which was that he saw himself as playing the top leadership role in the country and had that aspiration. And I guess one shouldn't moralize or judge over it. One should just notice that there was that aspiration. So much so that I think in the first government, when he didn't get the top position, he actually wouldn't be in government and just moved to walked the side. Away. So my view and my understanding is that, Cyril does like the idea of being, in that role and in that position and having all that comes with that position, the standing, the authority and so on. Of course, that doesn't always go along with, or maybe it does go along with the idea of actually leading strongly, standing on the deck, like a captain, taking the tough decisions. I think maybe one can reconcile it with the idea that actually, if you are then in that position, the main role would be to actually hold the different groupings in the ANC together, so that in fact you are kept there on the basis of you holding all of them together, and in fact all of them having that acceptance of you as that compromise position, rather than going out into an all-out clash. It's a role that I think is very good for the cohesiveness of the ANC, but it's not always good for what the country needs and where we need to go to. So this idea of the long game and taking strong decisions and so on, we are going to be, in the situation where we are in. In a period where there's, I suppose, stasis and no forward movement for quite a while yet.
Because, I mean, you talk about cohesiveness, but, I mean, there's open revolt from senior people within the ANC against the president of the country, sort of quite blatant, I would think, or I would say.
I'll analyze it slightly differently. I would analyze the RET group, the Radical Economic Transformation Group, as being split. One part of that group is in fact is happy, comfortable with the current setup within the ANC, the current power arrangements, in the sense that they would take the view that, all we need to do is bide our time. There will be another internal party election, and then we will have our time to be president. And they would take the view that, in fact, Cyril has not done enough to make a really strong case to get a second term. So that faction of that Radical Economic Transformation Group, as they call themselves, but obviously it's just really nationalism, would be trying to tell the other part to calm down, to actually act in a manner that is, less vociferous and
that
divisive.
Gives the illusion of more unity or more cohesiveness than there is.
They would say, pipe down with the attacks. Don't actually go all out for particular people alongside Praveen to fire them. But that side, their argument is, if we allow these things to continue, we're further away from the trough now, firstly. And secondly, some of us might get arrested. So that split is there, and in that split, but there is a part of their group which is saying, actually, this is a good deal. So, for example, the information I have is that the deputy president of the ANC, Didi Mabuza, is in fact very, very supportive of Cyril in a number of ways, and they are working together very closely sometimes to deal with things and issues that come up in the provinces, and there's never been an instance where, in fact, Cyril has been contradicted by him. So that's you know, that's the center of the airport. But then on the other hand, he's got to deal with people who say, well, actually, you have to speak out now. We want to go for Pravin Gordhan, who's actually an ally to Cyril and also would be a symbolic setback for him. So the reason, I guess, so Cyril's approach then to, it's interesting that, you know, Cyril has a wide appeal in the country and also among the business community. And so his approach is to these issues of whether, in fact, you're going to actually take corruption head on and move very fast on, I guess, cleaning out certain figures and influential people who, in fact, have been the ones that have been either actively plundering the state resources or facilitating it. His reason for going at the pace he does is, again, this thing that if I am challenged by these other factions as to why, actually, you, after our deal at NASREC, you are going so forcefully against us, he would answer that actually is not. The law is just taking its course. Mm. He has processes underway, and those processes are the processes of the land and of the constitution. And that's the cohesiveness that I'm referring to. And so far it's got a center that's held, but there is this wing of the nationalist group who believe in radical economic transformation and who still holds Zuma in high regard, who are chomping at the bit and really, really want, you know, really want to take the fight to the streets.
But I mean, let's be clear that radical economic transformation is nonsense. I mean, it's there was no plan for any radical economic transformation, was there?
No, I think what we talk about when we say RET, radical economic transformation, in their terms, it's I guess a packaging, a wrapping for a group and an agenda for them to advance to power. But it's actually the use of nationalism to get at power, and it's anything about the transformation in the interests of the people, but it does use things like, I guess, the racial structure of the economy as its starting point. But the end point is, therefore, as a result of that, there should be, I guess, permission for people from their ranks to receive contracts, tenders, all kinds of arrangements. And their means, I guess, of the redistribution is redistribution to connected people, connected families. It's not a social
it's
change.
It's not a national social project.
So it's just a term that's hollow, that's without meaning. And at some stage, they even, in crafting that term, engaged an international PR firm to help put that across. So although our economy is highly skewed, there's vast inequality, you know, on the one side, but on the other side, you have the other group who, I suppose, despite working with this phrase, are saying, well, we would then want to change that, so that in fact that that kind of inequality, that hierarchical society, looks very different and has many of us as millionaires at the top of that pyramid. We want to be, I guess, what the Anglo-American was in those days, which are the super millionaires. And so they are using a race lens, but not a class lens at all.
You mentioned NASREC, a deal. Was there a deal made? I mean, did Cyril Ramaphosa make commitments that he wouldn't sort of investigate corruption and that kind of stuff too deeply if elected?
So at NASREC, there was Yeah, there was a great deal going on, and I think as we learned later, there was a lot of money flying around. But towards the end, the arrangements that were made between Cyril Ramaphosa and T.D. Mabuza were the ones that finalized, gained the ultimate conclusion that Cyril Ramaphosa would be president. Yeah. So the nature of that and the details of that I wouldn't know, but the compromise then came from the part of Cyril Ramaphosa in relation to, well, how many of your group will be retained in positions
in the cabinet or in the NEC?
And looked after in a variety of ways, and how many would be like turfed out? How will sort of the dignity of your group sort of be kept intact? So that's the one part. But on the side of DD as well, there was also that compromise, because initially he was standing, and there was also a third candidate, Nkosazana Zuma.
Yes.
And that group was also, trying to lure him to support or to back that group as well. And I think in his terms was, actually I'll throw in the towel with Cyril. And many in the other group were very disappointed, because the other two groups, campaigns for president have a lot more in common with each other than Didi would have had, with Cyril's platform. Because these two platforms are they're very, very opposed. The one platform is saying, actually we believe in the way that Zuma administered the country. We can see very little wrong in fact the way cadre deployment worked, and the way in which money was siphoned off. That group was also very, very clear that, they did too little of that. Much more should have been done to use the power of the state to go to various SOEs, but also various firms in the private sector to lean on them to actually, transfer resources, power, votes, shares to people within the ANC. Much more should have been done. And they frequently point to some of the Gupta companies to say these are examples actually of companies where in fact black people were running things
and were being
empowered. Yeah. So these views were diametrically opposed, but at NASREC, agreement, a compromise, a reconciliation was done. And when, in the early days, when people who were close to Cyril were asked, why aren't we seeing a lot more movement apart from the appointment of one or two commissions and the installation of one or two people in the top structures of state security, why aren't we seeing more movement? And they answered very clearly, can't you see how precarious our position is? You should actually be considerate. The whole country should be empathetic about Cyril's position and why it is important for him to tread slowly and carefully. So we remember those arguments. So that's where we are, and it's I guess that's the dynamics within the ANC that's there, and the voters who voted that in are like you know, like the deer caught in headlights, they can't do anything about that. That's the one reality. And then the other reality is this inability to fix certain things. And the one that causes the most frustration with the public is the electricity. But there's a whole range of things which are not. And then the third piece of the reality.
Well, the SAA, there's the railways. Yeah. I mean, it's...
Yeah. So it's interesting that with the third piece of the reality is the state of the economy and the amount of job losses, and as well as the bad management in the private sector. So we've seen what's happened with the accounting firms. We've seen really big companies go under and their values.
Yeah, what was that?
Halved.
There was the big Steinhoff.
Tongaat Hewlett is one of those examples. I'm from the KZN area.
Yeah,
that company was an anchor company to, you know, in the province and to many of the communities. It's just unthinkable that, you know, Tongaat Hewlett wouldn't be there and would be laying off or would be laying off so many workers. With SA, it might be 1,000. So with the, you know, if you're sitting in the private sector and you're starting to lay off workers at this scale, when someone from government goes to them and say, actually, you know, you really ought to think of alternatives, you ought to take a wider range of issues into account and not just, you know, what's facing shareholders, their response will be, actually, look at the public sector. You yourself in companies you own are retrenching on a big scale or are facing retrenchments or thinking about retrenchments. And of course, the reason you as a public sector are in that position is directly as a result of state capture and looting. So normally you're on the moral high ground as the state, because normally the state keeps jobs and it's for various reasons of patronage. That's why
it's a secure sort of employment environment.
And your alliance in our case was the Nahawas and the Sattu, so you never lose jobs, so you have that position. But in fact, you are giving the bad example in a time when, in fact, you know, scores and scores, millions of families will be badly affected and the country would be set back. You're giving that bad example because once that gap is there and it's taken, it will be taken a lot easier. Because if you're a CEO and you can go to your shareholders about how, in fact, you can turn things around and actually in 1 month or 2 months from now, your salary bill will be cut. You really are... And, you know, in terms of capitalism and as a CEO, you are actually doing the thing that's admired. So the current situation is one that if I were in the trade unions now, I would be very worried. I'd see it as one of the worst crises that is facing workers and the working class. You know, our constituency becoming vulnerable, becoming precarious, the few who are in formal jobs, and seeing the need really to come up with something bold and innovative as a strategy.
Yeah, so it goes back to that sort of early point we were talking about, the sort of political influence of trade unions and what they can do in terms of economic policy. I mean, you see the World Bank saying 1% growth for this year, which is, I mean, that's nothing, is it? And people are saying, you know, we need 4-5% just to sort of keep our heads above water, and you just don't see. I mean, there's a lot of talk of, you know, opening up, not necessarily deregulating, cutting red tape, allowing people to open businesses, this whole sort of entrepreneurial class, or rebuilding a manufacturing sector in this country. Public works is another thing. I think that would be a sort of very low-hanging fruit. If you look at some of the state of roads, for example, in this country, you could, I think, put a lot of people. It would be temporary work, but it would be something that would give people some food on the table, and it would improve the infrastructure of the country. I mean, if you could wave a magic wand, just in the short term, how do you get from 1% to even 3 or 4% growth, given this sort of now re-obsession with the ANC in the mining sector and sort of very kind of, it would seem, old school, old school sectors of the economy that really have little to offer in the next 50, 100 years?
I think that South Africa and it has lots of potential to move things forward or to turn things around. So if you take our intellectual resources and our ability to pull think tanks together, which, you know, we don't do, we haven't been doing. We're able to get some of the best ideas on the table. If you take, our very dampened capacities to work together, you remember during the World Cup, our different sectors came together. And it's that higher level, that visionary leadership from the different sectors. And these are the things that come, like I said, not from individual companies, but from their top structures, not from individual unions, but from the federations. It's there, but there's not that. And then you take the actual resources in the country. So, the kitty is empty. But it is a country, if you compare it to some of our neighboring countries, places like Zambia, that has, you know, really vibrant economic activity in at least two or three provinces. Some are really depressed, and we know that each year through taxation, if we did it properly, we would do take in those those revenues. Almost automatically, given the economic activity. It's a bit like the trade unions. Trade unions are very financially strong. That's because they take their dues every month. They know that's coming in. So we've got that. So it is looking bleak, but those capacities are there. So, for example, I think one of the areas I would say we would need to start would be the thing about saying, well, where is it that we can do some kind of, I guess, expansionary activity that would give a boost to one of those sectors? It might involve some borrowing, but you can look around and find where is it that the government actually can inject a lot of public resources. The moment we often, and even myself being from the left, we often think, well, where can we actually give resources as transfers to people, and then we find it and we do. But where can we do that, for example, in creating that kind of, I guess, some expansion? So, for example, if you take our construction industry or our road building industry, sometimes we go through periods of a great deal of activity, and then sometimes we go through slumps. But when there's a lot of activity, there's a lot of job creation or access to jobs from people. There's a lot of spin-offs. So that would be one. Second one, I think, is really an easy one, is tourism, where it's become sluggish. It's gone backwards. There's been this issue around, the ease of getting visas.
The visas and the birth certificates.
Yeah, as well. And then we've been having some issues around the safety and security of tourists. And Miriam Altman, who writes now a regular column on Business Maverick, has pointed out, after studies she's done, I guess, in the last year, the quick gains you can make from tourism in terms of jobs, access for young people, the spin-offs in particular areas if tourism is pushed back up. And she translates some of those possibilities into the numbers. The next area I would say is a good possibility for government, is to look at housing. The one thing about housing, and yeah, I speak as my formal degree is in urban development, is that if you are not on that all the time, you will fall back. If you are not building really reasonable numbers of housing each year, it's going to catch up with you next year or the following year. And there might be combinations of ways in which you could do it, which involves, I guess, private sector yourself, but also sometimes community and access. And that could create, again, some vibrancy as well economically and a whole skills development, job creation. And I think in the production area, I guess one of the, and this relates, I suppose, less to economic growth as it does to the issue of inequality, is we really, if you think of production in the areas of food, so on, we really need to find ways to bring communities more into the picture as producers and contributors in the food chain using the availability of land. You know, land obviously is a premium, it's dense in about two or three provinces, two or three centers in the country. But beyond that, you have that availability. And I think at a time when, in fact, you know, the whole world is saying, well, we can, when we move away from sort of industrialized food, we actually get better food. I'm not one of those who talk about organic food because I think sometimes that thing has itself become restrictive and controlled. But in fact, when communities do it, they do it the right way. And this, to me, Nicholas, links to the idea of malls and I guess the big chains, and they have to be set up to be receptors. Why would you truck huge amounts of tomatoes and fruits to Limpopo when large amounts of those are grown there? And so you know, Woolworths should be getting it from the local areas. I guess the other thing to say about malls that worries me in terms of inequalities, that and I've mentioned this before, is that we all go and shop at malls, but most of the shops, they are white-owned. Apart from the anchor clients, the anchor shops, the other stores there are all chains, or branded shops, or franchise stores, and they are all often are white owned. So when we go to and we shop there, what we are doing is taking the money from the masses, and channeling it upwards to the haves. And really, we need to review that and look again at that and find creative ways, and we can. It's not difficult. Then I think in renewable manufacture, we could be getting a lot done there. I think
what do you mean by that, renewable manufacture?
The difficulties of getting the installation, I guess, solar panels, solar stuff. Just alternative ways of energy, but creating the industries around that.
Right. So producing our own solar panels, our own wind energy systems, things like that, and then enabling them to actually contribute to the power grid, because that's an issue we are having right now, that there seems to be an ability to create alternative forms of energy, but that the policymakers right now are living in the past still.
So, what's been a complete lack of vision has been the policymakers, because there have been numerous South Africans out there wanting to contribute. And again, sometimes one of the reasons, I guess, for slowing down or preventing movement in that positive direction has been a kind of old trade union thinking, which says, well, actually, this is Gwede Mantashe. If you make that move, our membership and our unions are part of an old system, you know, that's steeped in, you know, the whole coal industry. And we don't want that move, and we're going to block it at all costs. So, but what will happen is, out of desperation, numerous people will come forward and will make that contribution, but then communities won't be ready again, fostering inequality. So my thing is saying, well, why don't we be proactive and, in fact, ready the communities as well, co-ops, groups of people, to also make this contribution by the injecting of resources and bringing the communities on board in the supply of renewable energy. You know, many of us in the middle classes, maybe 5-10 years from now, as part of a side hustle, might have things on our roof,
sure,
which would allow us to get small income streams.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what happens, you know, to the people who are more marginalized? Mm. They're not able to make that upfront investment.
Yeah.
I think the last thing I would want to put on the table is, again, I think one of the things, you know, I was talking about your capacity to you know, to raise money through taxes. One of the things is that I guess, you know, you do need to consider every now and again in a country like ours is a once-off windfall tax. And, you know, every 3-5 years, you don't want to do it all the time. But again, in a, you know, you need to be clear as a leader what it is you're saying it is for. Make the case very, very clearly. Hit it. And when I'm saying hit it, I say hit us, those of us who have an, when have an income. It will be determined, I guess, by what you have rather than by race. But it will also have that flavor of, I guess, dealing with the past. So who are the beneficiaries of the past, but also who are the beneficiaries of the transition? So saying, well, actually now we're going to take a 2% or 3% extra from all of you this year. And there, you know, that's...
That would be then dedicated to a specific project or something like that. Because my fear is that, you know, people would look at that and say, well, jeepers, what happened to the 50 billion you've just put into Eskom for the last 10? I mean, the numbers are kind of quite far out. This
yeah.
bottomless pit at SAA. I don't know if that's
yes.
going to fly, Frank.
So no, it won't.
Well,
yeah, so
SAA is definitely might not fly.
So I think the thing about leadership and bold leadership in a country, if we go back to Cyril Ramaphosa, if you become a leader, you must take your two or three things that you're going to do boldly, and you might be loved and hated for it, but you've done it. So one of the things that when you do come to power as a leader in a country that's so divided is something that I guess relates to transfer of wealth or transfer of resources. So it's not ideal now given all the plunder, but if, for example, you said, we have a huge problem with regard to toilets in schools, children are falling into that, they're drowning. And I want to get this war chest going. And within 2 or 3 years, this will be the outcomes of that. We'll have eradicated that. No buckets, bucket systems in schools. And this is what I want to do. And take it or leave it, I'm doing that. You get respect as a leader for leading. But you're right, it is a difficult time.
If that ends in success at the end of 2 or 3 years, and you can say there's
yes.
no bucket system left in the schools, then you've got the opportunity to, in another 2 or 3 years' time, do that windfall again. But you would definitely have to prove yourself, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Capable of doing that. I mean, you went back to this idea of think tanks and that maybe there's not enough of that sort of policy around, but it seems that this government in particular is steeped in policy and ideas and lacks an ability for whatever reason to actually implement its policies and ideas.
Good point. One of the things that does make the ANC come back again and again as the winning party in elections is exactly that, is that it's out of many of the parties being able to generate good programs and policies. And so there's a good number of voters for whom, you know, that is the appealing thing. But you are right. I think that, we wouldn't be looking so much at policies in the current situation if you got a think tank together. We would be looking at initiatives that are job generating, and I think that the one area also where if you do have high powered thinkers coming together, is also I guess the area of the forthcoming I guess industrial revolution, the things which are coming to us. And we have to keep pace with those. And again, you know, these are This is where these are some of the areas where, in fact, the trade unions really have to do work to
apply their minds.
Yeah. So if you only sort of with your head down, looking only at sort of your next wage negotiations and your immediate issues of workers, and you are not looking forward, you will hold the whole state back, because when they want to do something, you would in fact resist those changes. So that is again another area as well. So there are some areas where we can, and then I think another area where we do need to have some really good and solid thinking is the area, I guess, of review and holding accountable. I'm not sure how you do that in society. We once had a department, well, we still do, of monitoring and evaluation, which said they would assess and review each department based on certain indicators. That's why they're monitoring and evaluation. And they would put something out to the public and say, these are the list of our departments. These are people who have really strayed from their core vision. These are the ones who actually didn't implement and returned resources. These are the ones which actually have gone further. They've had some setbacks, but they've gone furthest in actually using all their resources and, in fact, meeting some of the goals they've set. But we're not getting any of that out, and that's part of state capture. One of the things about state capture is you do make sure that certain departments which are keeping, I guess, a beady eye on things are, in fact, muted, subdued, and disempowered. So that's what happened. But when Colin Shabani was there, that was that vision. So we do need that. I think the last comment I want to make is about the location or the way in which poverty and joblessness is dispersed in the country, and also among different population groups. So one of the things that, like when you talk unemployment, you talk generically, but then when you look at young people, 70% of them are impacted. You look at unemployment and you'll get a figure in the late 30s for the general one and the expanded. But when you look at sort of black African people, then you're starting to go over 40. And when you look at black African women, it's 47. Then you go to, a provincial picture of this, and you start to see that rate again jumps up when you are in the Eastern Cape. And when you are in... So in South Africa, when you are doing change and transformation, or if you are implementing things on tourism, housing, production, you know, I do wonder whether, in fact, some of the leading thinkers cannot find ways addressing, really targeting things that where it's the worst or where those are worst affected. Sometimes that's not always possible. It's like when I was in development, if you go to an area which is totally, totally devastated and has very little, because now the confidence is gone, the skills are gone, you achieve much less. But if you actually put some development resources in a place which isn't the poorest of the poor, but then under the line, you get a lot of own contribution, you get a lot more vigor, you get a lot more energy and vibrancy. It's a difficult one. Yes, so we do need to think about what are the ways of when you are implementing programs, directing those programs to those who are most marginalized. But that often brings in its, you know, its own difficulties and challenges. And there are many people, economists, urban developers, who say, well, actually don't bother about that and actually accept that there'll be migration, movement of people, urbanization. And they feel that, you know, when you have large numbers of people in one place, it is much easier to address developmental needs.
But of course, the point then is, if you accept that there's going to be this massive migration to the cities, then the cities must be able to manage that, and there must be planning in place to build the infrastructure required, instead of these massive informal settlements, squatter camps, if I could be blunt, where people have no running water or electricity, or if they do, it's a kind of standpipe and a searchlight or something like that.
So in the last, I guess, few years, those informal settlements have been growing both in size and number. And I think we should bear in mind my earlier comment about housing. We've slipped back in the provision of housing. We actually, I think 2 years ago, a study was done which showed that we were delivering half the houses that we were delivering at the height, you know, of when the RDP program had been launched. So that has also then led to the kinds of conflicts we've seen around xenophobia. I think the other thing that it does bring us to is this discussion of the capable state at the local level. So I do like your point that if, in fact, you are going to be accepting that there'll be this massive movement of people, what facilities do you have? And you know, you have a couple metros, there's capacity there, there's a responsiveness on many fronts, they deal with many issues, and some fall off the table, but, you know, a couple of the metros are keeping things going forward. But there are this huge number of local governments where even new projects aside, even the most basic maintenance is not being being done and followed up. Infrastructure you do have in your hands is being eroded. So roads that you inherited that were good roads are becoming roads with potholes. The facilities that you need for, I suppose, providing pipe water to people, the sanitation systems as well, you know, in some cases they actually flow into rivers. So one of our big challenges in South Africa is, I guess, this capable state. And I think where we started, when we started the discussion, we were talking about how, in fact, some of these old stalwarts were talking about the public service. And we're saying you've got to inject some of them back in to this, because, in fact, the true thing about the activists is that they do go in every day. And they are fired up with this thing of making a difference, of serving people. And they can have that catalytic effect on other people. I'm not sure about whether that is the solution, but I do know that, especially as, I guess, someone who's on my academic side in urban development and who works at the School of Governance, is aware and very concerned about how much the civil service is costing us as taxpayers and how little we're getting out of it. And, you know, my sources in Treasury are saying it is across the board. I asked them, are you sure that...
when you say across the board?
In all departments.
In all departments, okay.
And in all provinces, they are saying that they are not getting the outcomes, that the level of motivation and the level of work, work ethic... work ethic rather than competence is not there. I think the interesting thing about competence is an interesting one. You need a lot of that. But sometimes if you have people who have a competence, but in fact they are deployed there in order to divert resources, then in fact they'll drag their feet on a project which doesn't have that element, and they'll work vigorously to finish the procurement and for one so there's this thing of will and skill. And will and skill go together. So capability is not just competence, it's will and skill. And their argument in Treasury, well, some of them I've chatted to, is that the staff members who had been there were not part of, were not brought in as part of sort of a nefarious deployment, would be this, you know, they're the same people with the same skills, but their work rate would decline because they would be working near or next to people who had been brought in this manner, and those people only apply themselves, you know, on projects that actually are of benefit to them, but otherwise don't work very much, and so they feel, well, why should they, and they become quite discouraged, another reason they give for actually people becoming demotivated in Treasury is that they say, well, if people, let's say you're sitting in a province in a department and someone says, well, you were this ethical person, why did you now get involved in this kind of scheme, which is corrupt, which is not kosher? They would say, well, people at the national level are doing that on a big scale, on much, much bigger projects. And so, you know, why shouldn't we? And they are our leaders. So throughout the government departments, I don't want to put a percentage on what is the rate of performance and output, but it is very low. So two sides to that in terms of consequence. The one side is the citizen. If you are a someone who is a group who's targeted for a program or certain services, you could be dealing with an official who's dragging their feet over a long time. Yeah. Or if you are a constituency who's waiting for a project that's been launched, and around the country, I've actually seen spray paint on walls saying this project is a white elephant. It's standing halfway up. It's never opened. So that's the one side of it, the consequence. The other side is for entrepreneurs. So you'd identify something that's a need there. You're in a particular place, a particular town. You want to put this service there. You're the entrepreneur, you know, actually it would bring benefit to people, your customers, probably things which are like really, really needed in one form or another in their lives. But you're needing certain permissions and certain things to be processed, certain approvals. And if the approval was meant to take you 1 or 2 months, and if it's taking you like 18 months, it just means that as the entrepreneur, 50% of you will go under in that time because you're doing all that legwork and nothing's moving forward. And then the other 50% will be there but will be very frustrated. Mm. So this is the consequences of the public services we have. But we do need a transformation, the public service, and I think at the top of my head, don't have sort of immediate ideas about how to turn that around, except to say that in the early 90s, schools like the PNDM adverts, but also the other schools of that were at other universities which were producing people to go into the civil service, produce people which were fired up, which were highly motivated, also with a sense of mission. And that isn't happening anymore. In fact, our latest information is that more people are going to do an MBA than do a public management course. And that's because they get it clearly from their own DGs, which is, I value that much more than I value a public management course. And the difference is that in the public management course, you are training people a lot more about values and ethics and the public good.
Hmm. Frank, let's leave it there. I'm not sure if that was a positive or a negative discussion, but it was a fascinating discussion, and I appreciate your time once again.
Yeah, thank you. And again, positive, we got the ingredients to turn it around. It's not going to happen anytime soon. And I think for anyone who's listening to this and who are voters in South Africa, you know, one of the keys is we've got to stand up. You know, sometimes you don't have many options when you vote, but when at least after you've voted, can you stand up for certain things? If you're not going to, don't be surprised if, I guess, things go off the rails, you know, on a continuous basis. That would be my message. Thanks so much.
Thanks again. I thought some of his comments about the current state and possible role of the trade union federation is quite interesting. Obviously, there's a lot of frustration there about, you know, particularly as the unions have stood by as SAA, Eskom, and other state-owned enterprises have been driven into the ground. And it's the employees, the workers, that will face the brunt of that effort. Also, his idea of a windfall tax I thought is interesting, but that is going to take some time to implement. Again, against the backdrop of our state-owned enterprises, that's a bottomless pit they seem to have become. And then the public service, and it's something I've mentioned in a couple of podcasts recently, the need for a functioning public service, a functioning, efficient public service, what he refers to as the sort of will and skill needed or required by a public service to work for the population and for South Africa as a whole. But despite his rather gloomy prognosis, I thought there were some green shoots of positivity. Voices from SA is hosted on Audio Boom. You may subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio Public, Deezer, or wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.